from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the U.S. economy grew at a rate of 3.2% in the fourth quarter of last year, a rise supported by the fastest pace of consumer spending in 3 years. But other indicators, such as a recent stock market slide and slipping consumer confidence, aren't as rosy. We'll take the pulse of the nation's economy and we'll discuss the future of the Federal Reserve under the new head, Janet Yellen, who was sworn in today. It's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Igniting hopes for a faster economic recovery, in a State of the Union speech last Tuesday, President Obama called 2014 a breakout year for the economy. And on Thursday, the Commerce Department reported a 3.2% growth in the economy over the final quarter of 2013, though on the whole, growth during 2013 was 1.9% weaker than the 2.8% increase in growth over 2012. How does the economy look now and in the year ahead? We want to talk about that this hour with a panel of experts who are joining us for the hour. We welcome, first of all, Kathy Bosjanic-Sick, who is Director for Macroeconomic Analysis with the Conference Board. She's with us this morning from New York City. And Kathy Bosjanic-Sick, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we also have Ludwig Kien-Carini with us. He's here in studio. He's Associate Professor of Finance in the School of Management at the University of San Francisco, author of The Crisis of Crowding, which is all about the financial crisis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Jerry Nicholsberg back with us, Professor of Economics, teaching Comparative Economics and International Business at the UCLA Anderson School of Management, and he is in Malibu this morning. Jerry Nicholsberg, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, if I may, Kathy, with you, Kathy Bosjanic-Sick, who is with us from New York City. And I'm looking at some new figures. U.S. stocks are falling sharply in midday trading today, pushing the Dow Jones average down more than 200 points. Investors supposedly reacting to reports of sluggish growth in the U.S. economy. This is after all that auspicious talk from the president and the State of the Union and 3.2 figures from the Department of Commerce. Where are we? Are we just in a different place for the time being?
Well, I think that our view is actually that the economy is getting on firmer footing, but not every data point always matches up at any given time with that view. And I think this morning the Institute of Supply Management, that's the ISM Manufacturing Index, did throw the market for a little bit of a loop. It decreased to 51.3 from 56.5 the previous month. And that's one of the earliest measures of economic activity that we get for a given month. And it's highly cyclical, so it does engender a lot of interest. And I should say that a reading above 50 indicates expansion. So it's still expanding, but at a slower pace. But overall, what we think is that dynamics are looking better for the U.S. economy, but, you know, moderately so. We're not looking for a really overly robust growth in 2014. We probably get to 3% at best. It could be even a little bit below that. But it looks as if the labor market's stable, generating, you know, roughly 180,000 to 200,000 jobs per month. Wages still remain low, but we think they could start to very gradually start to rise a bit because the unemployment rate is coming down. And we have a lot less uncertainty, right, in the fiscal side. At least we have some kind of a budget in place right now. And in terms of monetary policy, the Federal Reserve has gone ahead and started to taper. That's having huge implications on the emerging market economies and financial markets, but at least they've started the process.
Let's talk for a moment about that tapering, because it's particularly important, and that's the word that Wall Street gives it, particularly important in light of the fact that Janet Yellen is sworn in today as head of the Fed. They're reducing bond buying to $65 billion. That's down from $75 billion back in January, and federal spending is obviously being optimistic about the economy.
That's right. I think they largely hold the same view that we do, that the economy is gradually getting firmer. Now, the fiscal headwind, so last year, remember, we had the increase in the payroll tax rate So that shaved quite a bit off of after-tax income and the economy. And then also we had the sequester spending cuts, which we all know about, and the government shutdown, which altogether probably detracted 1.5 percentage points from GDP growth. So you had mentioned 2013 came in at 1.9. If you add in the fiscal headwinds, assume we didn't have them, the underlying economy was actually growing 3.4%, which isn't bad. And certainly better than, maybe the official number suggested.
Again, Kathy Bosjancic is Director for Macroeconomic Analysis with the Conference Board, and Ludwig Kincarini is Associate Professor of Finance in the School of Management at University of San Francisco. And Professor Kincarini, we're still looking at some pretty high numbers in terms of long-term unemployment. And housing, although, I mean, this is a bulwark, really, of what to judge the economy by, often in big numbers, although it's been moving upward, there's a decline in housing construction. So, again, how do we factor all this into the calculus?
Well, what Kathy said is true. This tapering that you spoke of will have an effect on the housing market. And so that is also the worry the Fed has. But housing will probably slow. My view is it will slow this year, maybe flat or down. And it really depends what happens to interest rates. But some of the banks have already laid off a lot of the staff that is in mortgage origination. So it's, I kind of agree with Kathy, but the party's ending.
You agree with the positive view.
I agree with the positive view, but the party is ending. So interest rates are coming up. And when the party ends, it's part of the reason we have the Dow going down. We have emerging markets suffering even more.
And what about consumer spending? The past 3 months of 2013, there was growth in consumer spending. A lot is based on that, the optimism at least.
That's right, yeah. So the third quarter GDP number was driven by two things. One that I think is slightly worrying, which was inventory investment by firms. And the other is consumer spending, which was good. So that's a positive. Consumer spending, if it continues, it should be good. But, there's the other side of interest rates going up and housing maybe taking a bath and maybe a few wealth effects from that, people feeling poor. I don't have a strong forecast on 2014 on consumer spending. Kathy or Jerry might have a better view on that.
Well, we'll hear from Kathy and Jerry more about the forecasting side of things, but I'm interested in hearing from you just on the turmoil that is emerging in market currencies. I mean, particularly among what's being described as the fragile five, Turkey, Brazil, India, Indonesia, and South Africa, a lot of volatility. And this is a global market now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, these countries, again, the catalyst, I believe, is this tapering. The party's ending. So you have a lot of effects. One is pension funds, for example, that have sought seeking yield in other countries like Turkey and other places. Now that yield differential is going to be smaller. It's going to be more interesting maybe to buy treasuries. So that's one effect. Some of these countries are having slight political issues. Turkey is one of those. And their growth is coming down. So if you look at Turkey, for example, their growth has dropped from 2011 to 2012. And so, again, the prospects there are looking less interesting. And people are afraid of these higher interest rates. And maybe it's better to get out of these countries before things get bad.
Well, just to stay with the global for a moment, Jerry Nicholsberg, China's manufacturing slowing down. How does that affect us?
So China is an extraordinarily important trading partner with the U.S., not just because we import manufactured goods from them, but we sell a lot to China. And China's slowing growth is, certainly of concern to us if we want to see export demand driving, at least in part, GDP growth. So that's, that's certainly something that we have to keep our eye on. China's got a particularly difficult problem now. They have previously been growing based on exports. That is over with. China is no longer the low-cost producer. With wages going up at a 14% rate per year. So China's got to change its economy to where it's producing for domestic consumption, and that is not an easy thing to do. And the implication there is that our export growth to China is going to be somewhat more muted than it has been in the past.
So how does Professor Jerry Nicholsberg see things shaping up? I mean, in terms of the economy taking off or another recession coming down the line, just in general, what are you forecasting?
Well, I think that when we look at the past two quarters, they're reasonably good compared to the previous ones. But if you go back in this recovery, we've had two quarters that have looked like this before. And so it's certainly not time to schedule a parade. It may be that we are starting to increase our economic growth, and we're forecasting about a 3% growth. That's a long-run average for the U.S., so that is not great economic growth in a recovery because the average is of downturns and upturns, but it's certainly better than the 2%. The encouraging news is that consumption is now a little bit more widespread, but we have to be cautious with that. As was mentioned before, inventories are part of that growth, and that inventory growth is not going to continue. It might even turn the other direction. And as well, on the consumption side, savings rates went down last quarter. And you can look as the stock market softens, as housing prices stop appreciating as much as they have, for savings rates to go back up. So I think that we're on the path to a 3% average economy. That's not a great economy. It'll take still a long time before we get back to our potential GDP.
Again, Jerry Nicholsberg is professor of economics and also with the UCLA Anderson School of Management. He's with us this morning from Malibu. There's a lot of talk, Jerry, about how the winter storms could affect growth in this first quarter or are affecting growth in this first quarter. But I'm anxious to hear what you have to say about California and particularly the effect of the drought and the impact of that on our economy here statewide.
Well, so far we have not really seen the impact of the drought. That's a longer term economic phenomenon. But if this were to continue, then we have real issues in agriculture in California. We have issues in some of our manufacturing. The idea that we can fully exploit the Monterey Shale now comes into question because we have water issues. So it's an important component as we look forward. But in order to get a handle on that for forecasting what's going to happen in California, not only do we have to forecast the economy, but also the weather.
Let me go back, if I may, to Ludwig Kincarini, who's here with us in studio, just to get back to the housing market for a minute with you. There was another report that came out last week from the National Association of Realtors, and they reported that it's been the best showing in 7 years for house sales. But home selling and price gaining are slowing.
That's right. I mean, the numbers are there. If you look at also the Case-Shiller indices, they're slowing. We had a phenomenal 12, especially in certain areas, San Francisco in particular. But this is slowing down, and banks are laying off people, which is another sign that the mortgage origination is slowing down. And interest rates going up will be a part of the story as well. As mortgage rates go up, we'll have a more choke off in demand. And the interesting part to also figure out, and I don't know the numbers here, is the foreign demand for American housing. So there are capital flows coming in from China and other places, mainly as a way to escape issues that they may have in their countries if they start to implode or other things go astray. So it's going to be interesting to watch the foreign demand for U.S. housing as well.
Well, we ought to mention that the higher U.S. interest rates have kind of rattled the global market, just to get back to the global picture again. But let me go back to you, if I may, Kathy Bosjancic. And I'm interested in your take about some speculation that the pace would have even been higher in terms of growth if it weren't for the government shutdown of nearly 3 weeks.
Right. Yeah, we had government, I think, federal spending as part of the fourth quarter GDP was down almost 13%, and that was widely expected, and it was a consequence of that about 3 week shutdown. And I think when you do the math, it detracted about 0.3 from GDP growth. Now, on one hand, it's actually surprising how well the economy did in the face of that, right? And I think a lot of us in the economics community were fearful that the shutdown would have even a more dramatic impact, and it seemed to generally be focused in that federal spending number, and you didn't have a lot of negative spillover effect as people had feared. So you had the second half of 2013, we actually averaged 3.7% GDP growth. Now, someone did mention inventories, and that is also a part that's interesting, part of this puzzle, and I think a lot of people didn't expect or understand. We had a build in inventories in the third quarter of $115 billion. That's quite large when you think about the trend being closer to, before that, maybe $30, $40 billion. And what happened is most of us in the economics community who forecast anyway, were expecting inventories to be drawn, the pace to slow down, and would be less of a positive contribution and less investment of companies in inventories. And actually, that didn't happen. Just the other opposite happened. We saw inventories accumulate even faster, $127 billion in the fourth quarter. So I do think that is a big question as to how those inventories are worked off in the coming quarters. Are companies optimistic, and are they building inventories because they think demand is going to be there for their goods? Or are they going to be surprised, disappointed, or are these unintended builds that are actually going to weigh on economic activity going forward?
That's a big question. Let me add a couple of big questions, if I may, and get your response. Another one is whether there will be an extension of federal benefits for the long-term unemployed, depending on legislation, because that would affect consumer spending, obviously, but also whether we're going to have more concern about the debt ceiling as we move along forward.
Well, I guess let me take the latter portion first. The debt ceiling, I guess you never say never in today's political environment, but it seems as if they learned their lesson and that highly politicizing the debt ceiling is not the way to go, and that we need to raise the debt ceiling and pay our interest on our debts, and defaulting is just not an option. But you really, we don't know, but it looks like that's less likely. Extending the federal benefits to the unemployed, I think on a micro level, is a very big issue. And I think obviously those people who are affected and relying on and getting help, it's a huge issue. From an overall macro perspective, we've seen the number of people who are getting that extended benefit, it was declining. And really the impact on consumption, and again, at the national level, would be pretty muted. When we did the math, it was, you know, maybe a couple tenths on spending.
But we still have a tepid wage growth. We still have low capital investment. We still have a debt ceiling. And if interest rates rise, it's going to slow down the housing recovery as well.
Those are all possibilities, and it certainly is a risk. It's something we'll be watching, the impact on housing. On the other hand, interest rates are have been abnormally low. We know that they had to rise, and I think the fact that they're able to rise and the Fed's able to taper back on quantitative easing is good news, because it means that the economy is starting to get back onto its own natural forces that are propelling it forward instead of this artificial stimulus. And if jobs, and the critical portion is wages, if wage growth can pick up a bit, and that's a big uncertainty, but if it does, then that will more than offset the interest rate increases. We always see interest rates rise as an expansion gets going and the Fed raises rates, and housing doesn't always get choked off, and certainly not immediately. And there's a huge pent-up demand in housing. Household formation has grown far below what it should. If we even see a modest rebound in household formation, that will underpin housing activity and demand.
But as you said, there's been this big buildup in inventories, and we should mention that we need to have buying with that. And that gets back to the whole role of consumers. Jerry Nicholsberg, there's high unemployment rate in California. That's why I mentioned the whole question of extending unemployment rates. I don't know how it's going to affect the economy here, but we're still in kind of a housing bubble, and we're out of the woods, one would imagine, as far as the deficit. So how do things look for you, again, forecasting in the state?
So there are several questions there. One is the unemployment rate in California, which is higher than the U.S. average. But if you separate California from the coastal communities and the inland communities, you find the coastal communities have unemployment rates that are lower than the U.S. average and inland higher than the U.S. average. Along the coast, we've had really good job growth, and that's where you've seen the appreciation in the housing and the aforementioned household formation is happening. And we're getting home construction, not so much inland. So we're really averaging a California that's been in a depression with a California that's booming, and then you get kind of mediocre unemployment numbers. As we're looking forward, we're looking to see both that dichotomy or bifurcation of California continue, but also the coastal California to continue outpacing the U.S. in terms of job growth. That will help the housing market. That's mostly multifamily housing, but it is housing, and it's residential construction nonetheless. In terms of Sacramento, which was your last question, you know, if you look at the budget, we start the year with more cash reserves than we end up, and we still haven't addressed the problem of the volatility of state tax revenues. So the nice words coming out of Sacramento notwithstanding, we still have the same problem that we had under Governor Schwarzenegger and Governor Davis. We have a system that is liable in the next recession, and to be sure there will be one, that will generate huge swings in state revenues.
When you talk about the bifurcated economy of California, though, it brings to mind the fact that there's not only a bifurcated economy here, but it really holds true throughout the United States. There was a discussion by city mayors last week. Scott Smith, president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, said, well, there's good news that there's no bad news. We've, as he put it, we bottomed out, but it's slow as far as positive increase of the economy. And you compare, say, a city like San Francisco with an average income of $75,000 and a 4.8% unemployment, that's half the U.S. rate, to other cities, or other cities are going bankrupt in California. And in the same vein, you know, you compare, say, Midland, Texas with and Bismarck, North Dakota to Mesa, Arizona, and you realize cities are bifurcated throughout the United States. It's like we have two completely different economies.
That's exactly correct. And, if you look at that across the U.S. In this recovery kind of start till today, what you find is the states and the communities that are growing fast and adding jobs, whether it's Texas or California or Utah or Minnesota, are adding jobs because they're being driven by a robust tech sector. And it's not just purely computers, but it extends all across the spectrum of technology. And if you look elsewhere, you find economies that are struggling. And you can just, you know, see that if you compare, for example, Texas with neighboring states of Louisiana and Oklahoma that have similar kinds of state fiscal policies, or even within Texas, depending on where you're at.
In fact, I was reading an article by Bill Connerly in Forbes. He says the outlook is good for the economy because of the increase in production of oil and gas.
Well, you know, that's certainly true. But you know, more importantly, what we've got is an increase in our tech-driven sectors. And that includes manufacturing that is using this much less expensive natural gas, because factories today are automating. They're getting much higher productivity out of workers by using robots. But the problem is that those who were laid off in the last recession who had mechanical skills need to come back with skills that allow them to install and maintain and operate robots who are doing the things that they were doing before.
Again, we're talking with Jerry Nicholsberg of UCLA and with Ludwig Kincarini, who is at USF, and with Kathy Boschancic, who is with the Conference Board, and with you. In fact, we now at this point invite you to join us, and we'd like to hear from you. I know there are many of you who have questions and concerns about the economy, so this is a time to voice them and to join our conversation, and please feel free to do that by phone. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Number to call, 866-733-6786. So please feel free to join the program. Again, toll free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and of course you can also join us by going to our Facebook page, but do feel free to join us. We'll continue talking about the economy, how things look now and up ahead in 2014. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the economy and taking the pulse of the economy. This opening hour of Forum, the U.S. economy grew at a rate of 3.2% in the fourth quarter of last year, and it's a rise that's supported by the fastest pace of consumer spending in 3 years. But there are other indicators, recent stock market slides and slipping consumer confidence that don't make it as rosy a picture. With us for this hour, Kathy Boschancic. She is Director of Macroeconomic Analysis with the Conference Board. She's with us from New York. And Jerry Nicholsberg, Professor of Economics, teaching Comparative Economics and International Business in the UCLA Anderson School of Management. He's with us by phone from Malibu. And here in studio with us is Ludwig Keen Carini, Associate Professor of Finance in the School of Management at the University of San Francisco and author of The Crisis of Crowding, which is all about the financial crisis. You, too, are welcome to join us, and you can do that by phone, toll-free, 866-733-6786, if you have questions or comments about the economy. We welcome them. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Let's go to our callers, and Peter, we'll begin with you. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. I'd like to comment on the fact that the key to the problem with our economy and the solution is that there are two. We have allowed corporations to accumulate and hoard $2 trillion, $2 trillion taken out of the economy. And they did that by lowering wages, laying off people, and when they say they want to bring some of it back, they're not bringing it back to create more jobs. What they're bringing it back is to buy more corporations, to give dividends and stock buybacks. Now, I mentioned that this is a poster child for the Keynesian paradox of thrift. Now, what the government needs to do is somehow get that money back, either through international treaty, tax it like property tax, and create jobs.
Let me go. Let me take your question, if I may, Peter, and pose it to our guest, Kathy Boschanek, who's with us again in New York City. Kathy, I mean, the corporations are not investing their profits due to a lot of fiscal and monetary uncertainty, but how much does that play into, lack of growth for that matter?
Yeah, certainly the fiscal and monetary uncertainty played some role. But I think you're right in that the biggest problem and obstacle to investing was a lack of certainty about demand for the goods and services. So I think we saw record profit growth, and the caller's exactly right. You had record profit growth. Companies have not, by and large, as a share of the profits, invested as they have previously. They've kept a lot of cash on the balance sheet. It could also be that after such a sharp downturn that we had in 2008, when many of the large companies were shut out of the commercial paper market, which is the short-term money market where they can roll over their investments just to fund daily operations, when that shut down, it was quite frightening. And we may have created this theory out there of Great Recession CEO babies. You know, just like we created depression babies. So it's unclear, but I think as the economy gets better, and maybe we look at this inventory build and inventory investment, and maybe this is the first step of them unleashing some of this investment.
Business is investing in more equipment, according to last quarter numbers I saw.
That's right. It was a nice expansion, almost 7%.
But they got to find the buyers, as I said earlier, right?
Right. They have to make sure that they get a return on their investment, and they have to make sure that the demand at the end of the day is there for their goods and services.
Did you want to weigh in here, Ludwig Kincarini? I mean, in terms of the role of corporations?
Just a little bit. The other thing I think to remember, which, in this world economy that we're in, there's a lot of competition from foreign countries, their labor force especially, and that's also weighing in on a lot of these decisions that labor is more expensive in the U.S. Vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And I think that's also affecting some of the decisions that corporations are making. Even though it's bad for us as citizens of the country, it's a reality that we have to face.
Jerry Nicholsberg?
Sure. So, I think that one thing that that we should recognize is that we are in a changing world. And so the recent announcement, for example, by Foxconn, that they're bringing the display manufacturing, so this is for smartphones, for iPhones, back to the U.S. from China, or to the U.S. from China. They've never been in the U.S. with that. Is kind of a case in point that they're manufacturing with robots, so the cheap labor abroad is not as much of an issue as it is the fact that the way in which we produce goods and services is. Kind of back to the original question, businesses are not going to expand rapidly when they see consumer demand growing at just about the same rate as GDP, and GDP growing in the 2 to 3.3% range, and so you're going to get a slow expansion there. You really do need the demand for the goods before you get the more rapid expansion.
Well, here's a listener who writes on our website, I've got to say the obvious, but why do we continue to import foreign workers on the order of 125,000 per month to take American jobs? Seems like an important step to getting the economy going is to get the unemployed back to work. We've been waiting for these jobs that are supposed to be created, and it ain't happening. Why not switch to Plan B? Want to comment, Jerry Nicholsberg?
Sure. The notion that we're going to expand visas for non-U.S. nationals to come here and to work and ultimately become citizens, you know, relates to the shortage that we find in many of the science and technology fields in qualified and trained people, first of all. And secondly, these are the folks that, you know, particularly in the Bay Area, end up being a significant proportion of the entrepreneurs who create jobs and who create new and growing and important businesses for California. So I think that, you know, the expansion of immigration to the U.S. of those who are going to help us grow our economy and create jobs is a good thing rather than a detriment.
Let me bring more of our callers on. Carrie, good morning.
Hi. We've been talking a lot about macroeconomics, and I'm more interested in regional economies and what regions and local economies can do to strengthen themselves. And I've even heard some discussion in the Bay Area where I live about trying to become more independent from Wall Street and trying to do more locally economics-wise. And I'd like to hear some thoughts about that.
Jerry Nicholsberg.
So I'm not sure about the becoming more independent from Wall Street because financial markets are not just national. They are, as was pointed out earlier, they're now global. And so there isn't really any way to kind of detach oneself. And it's probably not productive because our financial markets really mobilize capital and resources.
But they're also local, as the caller is indicating. And
you know,
how do we improve the local economies is really what she's asking.
Correct. And in the, you know, in the Bay Area, which the caller referred to, you know, if you go from Sonoma to Santa Clara, that's been one of the brightest spots in the U.S. economy in generating jobs and income. As you start going to the east, you get a very different picture, and even though agriculture in the Central Valleys has been generating a lot of income, we've generated very few jobs in the counties in the center. So, I think what we need to do locally is think about what are the advantages that that Stanislaus and Tulare and Kern and Kings, et cetera, counties have. And how can they play to those advantages? Because the old economy that they were built on just is no more.
Yeah. Let me go to Ludwig Kuhn-Karini.
Yeah, Carrie, thanks for the question. It's a great question. You live in the Bay Area, and I would say that one of the beauties of the Bay Area is, in fact, that they don't rely on Wall Street. If you look at the venture capital world, which Silicon Valley is the capital, and all the great creations they've done, Google, Facebook, all these and more significant companies than those. These are all really financed and run by venture capital companies that are local, and they only really depend on Wall Street for financing deals. So I think the Silicon Valley is a great example of doing things local rather than going elsewhere.
And Carrie, thank you for the call. Let me go back to Kathy Bus-Jancic. Kathy, the last caller, Carrie, said she's more interested in the micro than the macro and getting a read on local economies, but getting a lot of questions about minimum wage, and I'm wondering how, from a macroeconomic perspective or just from your perspective, you see it. Let me just give you a sampling of what we're hearing here or what we're reading from listeners. One listener writes online, just asks about President Obama's idea to raise a minimum wage and says, my opinion is it's treating the symptom and not the cause of wage salary disparity and will increase inflation. Another listener says, your guest only touched on real unemployment, very long-term regional unemployment, which continues in some areas 30%, unless they have new meaningful statistics, aren't increasing jobs largely at minimum wage, temporary or part-time and without benefits.
There's a real continued, I think, bifurcation, and maybe it's even more than bifurcation. It's a multifaceted differences in the labor market, and what we see, you know, more and more, and we see this also with surveys that we do at the conference board of our companies. There seems to be a mismatch between the jobs that are available and the skills that people bring to it. And it's no mystery that those that are seen as being more skilled and more productive are having an easier time. So I think that the one comment, it was a good comment, while we have to be aware, I think, of what the minimum wage is and how people are able to exist and be able to survive with their families. On the other hand, the underlying issues are what need to be addressed, but those, of course, take a long time to address, and it's education and opportunity, all the things that we know are there but are not quite easy to fix.
I'm reading a listener's comment online. Who are they kidding? If we have a good economy, maybe the 1% and a few others. The real fact is the U.S. economy stinks for most Americans. So while the U.S. as a whole is richer than ever, but the wealth is shifted to the top few, while most Americans are sent to the poorhouse with near-vanished middle class and tens of millions of people unemployed or underemployed and tens of millions of people on food stamps and some even going to bed hungry. Let's talk about inequality, and let's talk for the moment about the shrinking middle class or the attempt to get the middle class somehow boosted. How do you see things, Professor Kinnicarini?
Well, you know, it's a very important topic that this listener has mentioned. Inequality is a serious issue. There are some recent studies out, though, that actually show it hasn't changed that much over time, even though there's a big perception that it has. So I'm talking mainly about income mobility, that someone who starts out poor can get to a higher income class. That hasn't changed so much over time. So how do you address this? It's not easy because it's some of the things that Kathy mentioned. One is labor mobility, which is there are areas where there are regional unemployment. And one of the listeners asked, how do you fix that? Sometimes the fix is to move. And that's one of the great things about the U.S., that there's a lot of labor mobility. And sometimes an area just doesn't have the right production. It's not the right area, and you have to move to another area. That's one way to...
Again, there's a lot of research that backs up that some cities are flourishing and much more easy to get jobs in than other cities are.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So some of that's there. And then the other thing is, you know, a lot of these other things we're talking about, education, retraining. One of the big reasons we have a big pocket of poverty is that the world competition of labor, the technology that was mentioned earlier by Jerry, technology has replaced a lot of jobs that traditionally we would have done. And so we have to figure out how to retrain these people and help those people get a better life and better incomes.
Well, what about, Jerry Nicholsberg, just the overall impact of inequality on the economy? People need more money, or they need money, period, to buy things.
Well, that's right, and we talk about inequality, but inequality is multifaceted. So, if everyone stays still except for the upper end of the income distribution, and they become wealthier, no one is worse off. But inequality grows. So there are two issues. One is, you know, what about that upper end of the income distribution? The second issue is, as was just mentioned, was labor mobility, both social mobility and geographic mobility. And, you know, I think that we get a bit of a window on that if you look at the employment-to-population ratio in this recovery. It has barely budged. It dropped precipitously in the recession, and we're just about keeping up with population growth now, just slightly better than that. So as the caller suggests, that's not a great economy, and it's those folks who are not able to get jobs, who have the wrong skills or who are living in a location that is not growing and expanding, that really are experiencing a hard time in this economy, and they don't have the resources to buy goods, and that's part of the reason why we grow so slowly.
Well, and as long as we're talking about, just for the moment, not only population growth, but economic inequality, I'm looking at listener named Kurt who writes on our website, and you can do the same, by the way, at kqed.org/forum. At this time, the administration is pushing immigration reform, which will triple legal immigration outside of the proposed amnesty. How are we going to employ all these new settlers with the economy in such bad shape? Is there any way to attach the importation of foreign workers to the unemployment rate among domestic workers? Otherwise, we're just driving down the middle class and exacerbating the gap between rich and poor in this country. And let me get another viewpoint from Ann, who's joining us from Daly City. Ann, hi.
Yes, thank you. I feel that the person who was asked about immigration completely dropped the ball. The vast majority of our actual immigrants, the ones who are actually here, not what we're legally actually, you know, letting in legally, are low-skilled and, to some extent, medium-skilled. There's something like supposedly about 10 million to 11 million unauthorized. The vast majority of them are lower-skilled, low, possibly medium-skilled. The high-skilled immigrants that he's talking about that are supposed to, you know, help everything are on the order of maybe 200,000 or 100,000 a year. The math doesn't add up. There are millions and millions of low and medium skilled that we are essentially allowing to stay, and we're looking at importing also their relatives. And the number of high-skilled, yeah, we may be doubling them, but it was such a low number to begin with, that you're not altering the general labor market skill set out there. You're vastly increasing the low-skilled and only slightly increasing the high-skilled.
Hi, Ann. I appreciate your point of view, and I thank you for the call. I want to move on here and hear from another listener from Brisbane, and that's you, Victor. Good morning.
Oh, I'm from Greenbury, actually.
I'm sorry.
yeah, my thoughts are that there are lots of...
You and the coach of the Seattle Seahawks, yes.
From Greenbury?
Yes, he is.
Wow. I didn't know that. Yeah, he went to Sarah High or Sarah somewhere, right?
We went to Redwood High School.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
you got a solution for us, though, Victor. What is it? We need to hear some solutions here.
Yeah, well... it seems that what's happening is we progress. We don't have enough education for the jobs that we have. We have a lot of high-skilled jobs that need workers. So, for sure, we need a lot more education all the way up the grade, and it's policy have to fund it. The other thing is manufacturing jobs that are lower levels can go anywhere. They're going to seek the lowest labor because we have global corporations. And over time, more and more technology is going into the manufacturing process, requiring less and less workers, and productivity is increasing tremendously, yet workers aren't getting the benefit. The reality is we are going to need far fewer workers in the future to do the same thing as we do now. So the answer really is a 32-hour work week. We did it a long time ago. It went from 60 hours to 40 hours, 80 hours to 40 hours. There's no reason not to go to a 32-hour work week and have more leisure. The goal shouldn't be to continue to grow and grow and grow and grow economies forever.
Well, let me get Kathy Buschancic on here about shortening the work week. Kathy?
You know, it's an interesting idea, and it's something that has been tried in the past. Certainly we can look to Europe for that, where they'll have more of a truncated work week and almost job sharing to some extent. And
you need a lot more government support to make that work, though, don't you?
You do. And it is tough in our system, I think, to envision that. I do think there is an issue, though, and it's been brought out in many different ways here about the impact of globalization and increased technology and what that does to the workers. And I think you're also right. We need some solution. Maybe we need to examine the shorter work week, but I think there's also other issues that we have to look at and really think hard about this. And I don't think it's an easy questions to answer right now. There's certainly, in the short term, it's even harder. And then in the medium term, then the question is really, will these increasing technology take more and more jobs, or does it also create jobs? In the past, that's been the case. Maybe this time it is different.
Well, we just did a show an hour last week with a couple of MIT professors who have written a book about the next industrial age. It's all about the new machine age and how that's going to affect the economy. It's going to hemorrhage a lot of jobs. I mean, we need to prepare. That was their message, and that's an important message to have. Another message here from a listener named Bill in an email, Ludwig Kinkarini. He says, I thought corporations were holding all that money overseas while trying to get the corporate tax rate to zero here before they repatriate it. It certainly has an effect on our economy, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how much of that is going on, but it affects, I would
millions
say—
millions and millions of dollars.
Okay, so I would say it affects more government revenues and government spending.
It affects local governments, too. I mean, you know, if you've got a junior college in Cupertino and you've got Apple there not paying the kind of tax rate that would be normal if they didn't have the loopholes, the junior college suffers.
That's right. So— unfortunately, I don't know the tax laws as well as I should, but I would say this, that if that's something that one analyzes and thinks is a serious issue for local governments, et cetera, then, again, one needs to look at reforming the tax law. But it's still the case that some of this, that these companies are doing, I believe, is to be competitive worldwide. So it's unclear exactly, you know, how good or bad it is overall.
That's a whole other forum hour for another day. But just as a reminder, you are listening to Forum, and we're talking with Ludwig Kinkarini, also with Kathy Bosjancic and Jerry Nicholsberg. And this is a fundraising period for KQED. For more information about how to support KQED Public Radio, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another email here because it's something that, again, we could spend a whole hour, maybe a whole couple of weeks on. But this listener, Steve, writes, I hear so much from economists, investors, and academics, but I never hear information that helps me as a long-term investor. What am I to do with this information? Why should I care in the big picture about today's GDP, unemployment, China situation? 20 years, will any of this matter to me? Kathy Bosjancic?
It's a great question. And having spent 20 years on Wall Street as an economist, that is the challenge, that we don't trade GDP. But I think that you need to, in 20 years' time, obviously, today's numbers don't have a huge impact. But I think it's the shifting. And you have to be aware of what's the trend growth in U.S.? What does it look like? What's trend growth in China or emerging markets? And how does that play out, demographics at play, and also productivity, what we're talking about? And employment. So obviously we can't just focus on one data point today. And to be a long-term investor, I think you have to have a sense of where are the growth and where is the contribution to world growth looking ahead.
Well, Ludwig Kinkarini, you may not want to give investment advice, but you want to address the question?
Yeah, I don't. Steve, I like the question a lot. I don't want to give advice, but And I agree with Kathy, if you have a long-term horizon, you're doing a long-term asset allocation, these ups and downs really don't mean a lot to you. However, you can tweak your portfolio. There's things that might be true this year. For example, it might be good to be long the U.S. dollar. This is just an idea, not an advice. Housing may be flat or down. Emerging markets may suffer this year. And treasuries, it's ambiguous if it's going to be up or down. That's my personal opinion. So there are things you could do. For example, if you really think this tapering is going to hurt emerging markets, pull a little back on your asset allocation to emerging markets this year. That's something you could do.
Well, Jerry Nicholsberg, I mean, you're always looking at economic forecasts. When you get into 20 years, actually, sometimes it's hard to get into next week, right?
Exactly. So my comment to the listener was, or is, the way to understand this is to go back 20 years from today, look at what all the forecasters said about politics, economics, and what industries would be ascendant and what would not be, and find out how horribly bad they did. And, if you're forecasting out 20 years what the world is going to look like, you're going to have a hard time. So you need to look at those things that you think are important trends. And then you'll be speculating on them. But we as forecasters don't do well in long-term forecasts. The best forecasts that we make are based on estimates of population change, demographics, rather than any of the current things that are going on in the economy this year or next year.
And let's hear next from Phil. Phil, you're on Forum. Good
yes.
morning.
I'd like to know if the Dodd-Frank is simply giving us a false sense of security. The Wall Street people are writing the rules. Barack Obama won't take on the big banks. The big banks are getting bigger and bigger, and there's no one wants to take on the big banks. It seems as if he wants to get jobs for his wife and his children. Doesn't he take on the big banks and break them up?
Well, it's a good question in itself, but Ludwig Kinkarini used to work on Wall Street. I mean, the fact of the matter is Wall Street's giving a lot of money to President Obama, has given a lot of money to President Obama, and false security from Dodd-Frank? Yeah, I would say it's false security.
I think you're right. You know, false security in the sense, but here's what I would say, not in the way you're thinking, in the sense of I think it's hard to totally remove the fluctuations and volatility that an economy will have. And so I think, Dodd-Frank, you are right to a certain extent. It's not going to do a lot. There are some things that are good. For example, some of the new capital ratios for banks are going to make banks less levered. And that is good for everyone because less leverage in the system means less volatility. So there are some things that are good, but I do agree with you. Generally, a lot of it is trying to regulate something that's difficult to regulate.
And no one's going to get prosecuted. I mean, the statute of limitations is right just upon us. Let me thank all of you for being with us. This has been an enlightening hour, and I appreciate the participation of the whole panel. I want to thank Ludwig Kinkarini, and his book, again, is A Crisis of Crowding. It's about the financial crisis. He is associate professor of finance at School of Management, USF. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And thanks, Kathy Busjancic, who is, again, director of macroeconomic analysis with the Conference Board, who joined us from New York this morning. Thank you, Kathy.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Jerry Nicholsberg, professor of economics and with the UCLA Anderson School of Management, who joined us by phone from Malibu. Thanks, Jerry Nicholsberg.
A pleasure.
Thank you, our listeners. We are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can continue this discussion on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And we have another hour of forum up ahead for you. We're going to talk with John Carman in the hour ahead, a sergeant with the California Highway Patrol who's been saving lives of people who want to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. He's been doing it for many years. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.